All right, Chit Shows, if you were someone who constantly finds yourself giving, giving, and then giving more to the point where you are completely burnt out, listen up. I am teaming up with the Boundaries Queen herself, Barb Nangle, to host a transformative workshop called Stop Overgiving, Repair Your Life from the Inside Out. It's happening on Wednesday, November 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and this workshop is for anyone who is trapped in people-pleasing patterns, exhausted from sacrificing your needs on behalf of others, for anyone whose inability to set boundaries is causing you to neglect yourself, saying yes when you really want to say no because you think saying no makes you a bad person. In this workshop, Barb is going to teach you how to set clear, authentic boundaries, giving you real tools you can start using immediately. She will provide you with tips and scripts on what to say and how to say it, as well as what to do when people push back against your boundaries. Plus, there will be plenty of time for you to get answers on your personal questions directly from a boundaries expert. So if you are ready to break out of this people-pleasing prison you're trapped in, start living for yourself, well, how about you head to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops to get your damn spot. I'm also running a special right now. If you join the Shit Show community between now and November 1st, you will get access to this workshop for free. So with limited capacity, make sure you get your ticket now before it's gone. So either go to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops or go to the show notes and DM the Join Shit Show. Trust me, this is a workshop you don't want to miss. Stay away from people who make you feel like you are hard to love. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. What you're holding on to, just let it all go. What's making you slow now, just let it all go. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am a recovering alcoholic. I am an adult child of an alcoholic family. I am in active Candy Crush addiction. I am a lover of carbs, condiments, and cheese. And I just had to pull myself away from this Karen Reed trial. Who the hell is watching this shit, y'all? It is giving. It is feeding my addiction to excitement. So for anyone who's not familiar, there's a woman, Karen Reed, on trial for murdering her boyfriend, who was a police officer outside of Boston. But there's no fucking way that she did this shit, y'all. I highly recommend checking this out. I watch it through Emily D. Baker on YouTube. And you know it's good when you go to bed on Sunday night and you're pumped for Monday morning so that you can you can watch this trial. So, you know, you got to pick your vices, y'all. You know, like Candy Crush and murder trials on YouTube is a lot better than alcohol and emotionally unavailable men. Am I right? So today we are joined by Matt Colick. So he is a musician and an alternative rock and roller who has a new album that is dropping on June 21st titled Family Plot. And this essentially is an ode, a tribute to us shit shows of dysfunctional families. So there are two sides of the album, or the album is split in half, with the first part being all about his childhood, the trauma and neglect that he endured, being the highly sensitive child growing up in a family and in a world where, you know, we keep our mouth shut, we keep our feelings to ourselves. And then the second side of the album is all about his, you know, recovery, transformation, healing, and his decision to go no contact with his family. So this is just a real and raw conversation that you guys will get a lot out of and relate to a lot. See the show notes for all of Matt's shit, for his album, all the things. You can find it in the show notes. So speaking of family estrangement and going no contact with toxic family members, I posed the question, how many people are no contact with any of their family members? And so here's what I got. So 48% said, yes, they are currently no contact with at least one member of their family. 12% said that they previously were no contact with a family member. And then 38% said no. Hello, it is Andrea from the future editing this shit and realizing that doesn't add up to 100. Former CPA here. I can't have that math error. I just went back into Mighty Networks to see, was that my error or their error? And it's their error. They do not round up. They're not rounding up their numbers. But here's the good news. I have some more, accurate data now because more people have voted since I first recorded this. And I had to go through and round up since I guess Mighty Networks doesn't know how to round up because their numbers are still only adding up to 98%. But here we go. We have 47% now, 47% saying that they are currently no contact with at least one of their family members. Then we have 13% that say previously they've been no contact. And then we have 39% who say, no, they are not no contact with any of your family members. So let's talk about this some. It really is a personal decision. It really is unique to each and every one of us. I think there's certain people that know that they have to close the door permanently. Like there's no way that they're going to be able to get to a place where a relationship with certain family members isn't going to be, you know, nothing but toxic in their life. I think that for some of us, it is a good idea to maybe go no contact when we are first starting this healing journey, because if you are trying to work through, process, and heal the shit that happened to you during your childhood, it's very difficult to do that if you are continuing to be triggered in the present by these people that you're trying to resolve the past over. So I think for, you know, for some of us, it's probably a good idea to take a break, and that maybe when we have some recovery under our belt, some healing has taken place, we might be able to get to a place where we can figure out how to have a relationship with our family members in a way in which that works for us. So I think that it's really important to emphasize that, you know, when you decide to go no contact with a family member, like this isn't a decision that we are setting in stone, right? Like this is a day-to-day decision. And today it might not be a good idea to have a relationship with certain family members, but that doesn't mean that down the road, as you heal and recover, that you might be able to get to a place where you can have certain boundaries in place that allow you to have some sort of relationship with them that is not like totally hijacking your peace of mind and your serenity. You know, for me personally, there have been periods of time where I've gone, you know, several months without speaking to my parents. And I will tell you, I had some stuff that happened over the holidays around Christmas time where, you know, where I was being put in that scapegoat role once again. And it got verbally abusive. And I was very stern with both of them. I said, I'm done. I'm not doing this shit. I'm not the fucking problem here, okay? I wasn't the problem when I was a kid. I'm not the problem now. I'm the only person in this family that is in recovery and sober. And if you want to have a relationship with me, you have to stop this shit right here, right now. I'm not fucking around. I'm done playing this role. And that message was received. So again, I think it really is just a personal decision. I think some things to consider though, like what would be some reasons to not go no contact with family members? Like if you are doing it as a form of punishment, that's not a good idea. If you are doing it from a place of thinking that somehow that's going to change them, that's not a good idea. If you are doing it out of guilt, or like peer pressure, if maybe one of your other family members is pressuring you to do so, that's not a good idea. It really has to be about like what is truly best for you. It really needs to be coming from a place of your healing. Is this relationship hindering my growth, like my progress, my healing? and choosing yourself, right? For some of us, going no contact can be extremely painful and sad. For others, it is quite a relief. Like, we had somebody share on Mother's Day in the Shit Show group that this was their first Mother's Day being no contact with their mom, and that it was actually such a relief. It was like such a relief to not have to, you know, feel the guilt and obligation to send your mom a card or, you know, call her and say Happy Mother's Day. So as I said, it's truly an individual decision that we all have to make. So let's get the damn show on the road, folks. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn their own shit show. Damn, that didn't come out well. Damn the join shit show. In the very beginning, when it used to be Patreon, one time I by accidentally said, instead of join the damn Patreon, I said damn the join Patreon, and it stuck. So damn the join shit show. This is where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. This is where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are truly doing the work to heal. This is the spot to be. This is a fucking dollar a day, folks. A dollar a day for your healing. Is your recovery worth $1 per day? I would say absolutely. So yes, you, the one who's been wanting to join for forever, ask yourself, what do you have to lose? You can quit after a damn month, okay? Damn the join shit show. See the link in the bio. Next, sign up for my damn newsletter. I'm going to be sending out one this week. It's going to be a video on being assertive. So it comes from this book called When I Say No, I Feel Guilty, How to Cope Using the Skills of Systematic Assertive Therapy. So I'm going to be discussing some of our assertive rights that we all have that I think will be very useful for everyone. So see the link in the bio for that as well. Give me a damn follow on Insta, on TikTok. And last but not least, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. We got a fellow shit show. Do we consider you rock and roller?
Yeah, we can call me a rock and roller.
We can call you not like an alt rock and roller?
Yeah, alt rock and roller is probably, if we're going to drill down a little more, alt rock and roller.
Let me see, alt alternative rock. What do I really mean?
I guess what I think of, and I'm a child of like the 90s. So okay. for me, it makes me think of bands like the Pixies. And like college rock, bands like Faith No More, like Ween, stuff like that. Like, I asked this question on Instagram the other day, and people were coming at me with all sorts of different stuff. That's like, no, that's not alternative rock. I'll tell you what alternative rock is. It's from the 90s. So it's kind of not necessarily, you know, I'm obviously not making music in the 90s anymore, but it has that spirit. It has the spirit of kind of out there, somewhat edgy, accessible, but a little quirky, a little weird, and it's not the mainstream. However, it might edge into the mainstream a little bit as it did in the 1990s. So does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. So who's your, like, you can only listen to one artist for the rest of your life. Who are you picking?
Probably Ween or James Brown. I'm not sure.
Mine, you probably will make fun of mine. Mine's Billy Joel. I'm like a Billy Joel freak. So
yeah, I love Billy Joel. What is your go-to Billy Joel like era album song?
Okay, so I mean, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant is always just so good because it's like three songs in one. But do you know the song Billy the Kid?
I don't think I do. No, it's not coming to mind.
Listen to it.
Okay, I'll check that one out.
I feel like he has so many different sounds. I don't really like 80s. I'm not like Weed and Start the Fire. I'm more the, you know, the earlier albums.
Yeah, same here. I definitely gravitate towards those more, the 70s era than the 80s era. And the
he's so good. I've seen him perform a couple times, and he always has to go out of his way to point out that he not only writes the music, but he also writes the lyrics. Since Elton John doesn't.
Exactly. I was going to say, is that a shot at Elton?
Yes. And I think what it comes down to is like that Elton got sober and Billy did not.
Fascinating.
Because, you know, they used to tour together. And I think they had a big falling out. And I think it was around Billy's alcoholism. So, because Elton's been sober for like 32 years or something. Yeah, so you're in New Mexico?
That's right. Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Can anybody say anything about that without saying Walter White or something? Like,
it's almost impossible.
Shit?
I wouldn't say I'm sick of it, but I've accepted it.
Rust. Where did you come from?
I came from Wisconsin. I'm an upper Midwestern boy and with everything that goes along with. So yeah, I moved here during Breaking Bad and in the height of it, and I was a fan of the show. And so that was an interesting thing. Ended up moving in with my partner into a house that had been used as a filming location for the
show.
Yeah. So occasionally we would get people stopping by and taking pictures and stuff.
What was filmed there?
I don't know if you're familiar with the
show. Yeah, I watched the whole thing, of course.
Okay. It's Jesse's girlfriend, Andrea.
The one who OD'd and died?
The one who got shot. It was the house that he moved her out of to move to a better neighborhood. It was that house. So when they first started dating.
Was she a heroin addict?
Right. They met in the sobriety support group in the 12-step group.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was her house. And yeah, it was like, it was only used in like one or two episodes, but still there was a guy from Holland who came by to take some pictures. And he had his Walter White shirt on and everything. Like, it's crazy, the fandom. So
I bet
that is kind of the dominant thing.
There's probably like tours, right? Like, where you just go see all the locations.
Yeah, there's a trolley tour.
So I don't want to start with your childhood. We'll start where I always start. When did you come to terms with the true impact that your childhood had on you?
Yeah, again, just layers. Like, I don't know if there was a single moment. It's just been a continuous reawakening to this fact. For me, I had sort of a spiritual psychedelic awakening, which a lot of people have come into this world through that door, which really cracked open a lot of things. And it revealed to me that there were incidents that happened during childhood that in adulthood, I would tell the stories of those incidents. I would be laughing and, oh, here's this funny story from my childhood. And everybody I'd be telling the story to would be somber, serious, and oh my God, like they were not giving me what I wanted in terms of a reaction to those, my funny childhood stories. And so it occurred to me, that stuff that happened in childhood that seems to be so awkward when I bring it up now in adulthood, that's actually this stuff that's led to my problematic life with, you know, dropping out of school and addiction and like not like being broke and not like being evicted from apartments, getting my car repossessed, like all of the worst shit, feeling like I'm just a completely irresponsible person.
So I'm curious what your experience was. I mean, was it in a therapeutic setting or you're just like doing drugs?
It was absolutely not a therapeutic setting. It was I was sort of at a rock bottom. I probably could have hit a couple more rock bottoms beneath that, but it was a rock bottom when I was experiencing some suicidal ideation. I was thinking about, you know, it wouldn't be so.
How many years ago was this?
Right. I was 37 years old or 38 years old. So almost 10 years ago, we just celebrated the 9-year anniversary of this. Yeah, I'm 47 now. So it was when I was 38 years old and I'm finding like this, that's kind of an age when this stuff sort of cracks open for people. Mm-hmm. But I was at a low point experiencing suicidal ideation, dead end. I was thinking I can walk out there, get hit by a bus, or I can walk over to our version of Skid Row here and like become a heroin addict and overdose or something. And
were
like,
you in New Mexico at the time or were you in Wisconsin?
Okay. Yes. Here in New Mexico, I was like such a loner. I didn't really have a network. I didn't have people. I was at a point in my life where I had achieved my goal of just being by myself and not being bothered by other people. And then I realized, oh my God, this is horrible. This sucks. I need people. But I can't connect with people and I'm useless and I can't pay my rent in this little efficiency apartment. And so I don't know what I'm going to do. And yet I didn't have like the courage enough to really, you know, make a choice about it. So one night I decided I'm going to grab this baggie of mushrooms from the back of my closet, just take those. I think I drank a half bottle of cold medicine. There was a bottle of vodka sitting there that, like, yeah, we'll chug this. I started feeling a little groovy. I walked to the grocery store, bought a bottle of wine and drank it on the way home, walking through the alleys, through the city. On the walk home, though, I noticed it was almost like a physical feeling in my body, like a literal shift in my body where, I don't know, there was like a humor and a reverence, a lightness about all of this stuff. I started thinking about, I could get hit by a bus, haha. Like, yeah, whatever, I'll die. Who cares? I'll just get reborn again. Or like, I started thinking like in terms of like it outside of myself. It's not just about me. It's like, I'm just a piece of matter in the universe that's made up of all the same matter that everything else is made up of. And then when I die, I become matter and I make other things. And maybe that doesn't sound soothing to anybody, but to me at the time, that was like such an awakening. It is. Yeah. It's like, and yeah, and now these days it's like, oh yeah, how the hell did that wake me up? But it did. It really was about getting outside of myself, getting outside of my brain, seeing myself as, and I was like a hardcore atheist, materialist, angry person. And it really just kind of cracked those walls down and broke those walls down to where like, well, maybe I'm not. Maybe I do kind of believe in like, not necessarily God, but sort of like a universal sort of feeling of love and life and connectedness and the universal flow of energy. And so that was one night and it like kind of tore down the walls, cracked things open. I was very skeptical of what was happening though. It was like, nah, I don't know about this. I don't know about this. This feels like real, feels like I'm actually shifting, but I'm skeptical. And so the spiritual awakening process actually took about a week. Like a week later, I obtained another bag of mushrooms and intentionally took a trip this time, having been through the experience I had been through the first time with the mushrooms. And I thought, okay, now this time I'm going to take them intentionally and deliberately explore these places, deliberately explore the places where I'm hurt, where I'm feeling depressed, where, because fuck it, what do I have to lose? I want to die anyway. It's like, there's nothing that's going to be scarier than that. So I'm going to take these mushrooms. I'm going to go to the dark places. I'm going to go into the dark cave and face my demons. And that's what I did. And for maybe a month after that, I was just riding this high on a cloud of non-duality. Like the actual kind of breakthrough awakening.
Well, and you're like, okay, you take these things. And you said, I'm going to explore these. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. Are you like laying down, closing? Like, what? Like, how does one go there? What are you doing?
Yeah, great question, because it's all like, yeah, I'm talking about like going to a place, but
yeah,
you're right. I am just lying there in bed.
I'm just curious if there was like any sort of like methodology, but and was this something like, was this just solely based off the experience that you had had? Like, did you do any reading about it or you just were just based off that one experience that you had?
Yeah, great questions. There's a couple things I'll say to that. In the midst of all this, I had been going to therapy and the therapist had recommended this book called The Happiness Trap, which I'm not sure you're aware of, but it's a lot of like Buddhist Eastern spirituality principles of meditation in a secular non-religious package. And that's basically the concept of this book, The Happiness Trap. And I was reading it. I was like theoretically bought into it, but it just wasn't clicking. I was just way too skeptical. And so I think having had those concepts of Eastern spirituality and mindfulness meditation, those were all kind of at work in my head, even though I wasn't like clicking with them. I think the fact that I had been working with that stuff really helped connect with the mushroom experience and the psychedelic experience to where I could see the connection between those two things. Like the psychedelic experience is a way in to that world of mindfulness, meditation, presence, like getting outside of yourself and connecting with the larger universe. And so there was that. And then there was a lot of like YouTube watching in the week between I took the first dose, like the unintentional dose, and then the intentional dose. Yeah, just watching like Alan Watts lectures and Ram Dass stuff and Timothy Leary stuff and like people who kind of were giving lectures or talking a lot about like the psychedelics and spirituality connection. And so that was, yeah, in the psychedelic world, we call it packing for a trip because you're taking a trip. And so you want to pack really well for the trip and make sure you have what you need for the experiences you're likely to encounter on that trip. And so
what did you experience on that trip?
Yeah. And so that trip was, I was actually just sitting there in my lazy boy recliner in my little apartment.
No cold medicine this time?
No cold medicine. Strictly the mushrooms. Yeah, no. And like, I've been a cannabis user off and on pretty regularly. And at that time, I was like, I'm going to hold off on the cannabis. I think that might have an impact on this, that I don't want to have that combination at work here. I want to have the pure mushroom experience. So yeah, I was just lying there in my recliner. I think I put music on. I had discovered a playlist that was used at Johns Hopkins University for their psilocybin trials. Oh, yeah. And it's like gentle music, a lot of classical music, a lot of Bach. And I closed my eyes and I began to, began to see what they call sacred geometry. And it was like the music creating architecture in my mind. And I had been out of music myself at that time. And that's what started reawakening my desire to like get back into music and perform and write songs. And it just kind of opened my mind to the reality of the universe. Like everything is vibrating. I'm vibrating. I'm not. The main thing that it did was it broke down the rigidity of my thinking into something called in the book, The Happiness Trap. They refer to it as psychological flexibility. I had been so rigid and so sure of things, so sure of myself and what I knew about the world. And like, yes, I'm very intelligent. I know better than you. And I was not open to anything other than what I knew up here in my head. And so what it really did in a very playful manner through the sacred geometry, through the kind of just the playful irreverence of the experience, it broke down that rigidity. It's kind of took those right angles and made them like kind of curves. And yeah, I believe this, but you know, there might be some truth to this over here. And yeah, just kind of stuff like that. It expanded the idea of who I could be, who I was as a person. It kind of broke down the ideas of the roles that I was put in my family construct and what I believed about myself from such a young age through growing up in the family I grew up in. It's hard to find a word better than awakening to describe the experience.
Okay. So then you said you were riding a high from that for about a month?
That's right. Yeah. And it was like sort of, it was almost as if I was still like literally high on drugs and like feeling the non-dual feeling of I am like one with the universe. I'm one with that person walking their dog. And I actually am one with that dog too. And the leash and the pile of poop that they're scooping up, right? I'm one with it all. And so, and it was like really magical. And it was like, I could finally rest and relax and feel okay about being myself. It was like the metaphor that kept coming up was you're off the hook. You're off the hook. You don't have to worry about all that junk and maintaining that, whatever you felt like you had to maintain up here in order to like keep your tight grip on life. You can breathe. You're off the hook. Then I remembered one day I was riding my bike and somebody cut me off in their car. I was like, fuck. And whoa, wait. I thought I had gotten rid of all of that.
And now, enlightened.
I thought I was over that. I thought I was like a spiritual Buddha. Guru now. Exactly. I thought I had become the Buddha, but no. In fact, like, and then after that initial month, it was that experience of now we have to integrate these things. Mm. It's not just I took a pill, I took a medicine, and I'm good now. I have to do some work. I have to, like, those old trails, those old pathways in my brain are still very well-worn and very obvious to walk down versus the new pathways I'm trying to create. And that's going to take some work. That's going to take a lot of work. And I don't know if I want that. I don't know if I like that. I thought this was going to be easy and fun, but it's not. And so I decided, I guess I'm going to do the work now.
And what was that, like going to therapy?
It was continuing to go to therapy, continuing to read the literature, continuing to like put myself out there and like recognize that I have value as a person. I have, my pursuits are worthy of pursuing. Like, it doesn't matter what my mom thinks or what my mom thinks other people are going to think about her because of what I like, that whole mess of stuff. And so for me, the work was really being present and noticing when I'm going down those old familiar pathways, doing the things that I have discovered that soothe me when I'm feeling bad. It's avoiding those things. It's like getting out and exercising and going for a walk. I'm not sober, but I'm way more sober than I used to be because I'm just so much more mindful about its impact and what happens when I go down that road. It leads to a place I don't want to hang out at a lot of the time. And it's made me more serious about like finding community, finding people, because I rediscovered my self-worth and, oh, I am worthy of friendship and love and partnership and all of that good stuff. So I say work, but it was really just it required effort, but it was all it's ever done was bring good stuff into my life. And so, yeah, I'm happy to do that kind of work.
When was the complex PTSD realization?
That was very recently. Like there was a spiritual awakening 9 years ago. And as is the case in your story and in so many of our stories, like, wait, like there's finding out stuff. And I think it was on a spiritual journey subsequent to the awakening experience where I thought really hard about times in my life where I've been like literally held down against my will when I was a young child, something that happened repeatedly that impacted me tremendously and negatively was I was held down by older siblings, cousins, and their friends. I'm like 10 years younger than all the rest of like the equivalent generation in my family, all my cousins. I was like, my parents were old when they had me, so I never really fit in with them. So I was literally held down by the older cousins and siblings and stuff and tickled until I peed my pants. Mm. Like it was a party trick they knew how to do. And I learned how I had to just kind of sit there and take it and like dissociate. That makes it better. And that was one of those stories I would tell people about and like, ha ha ha, this happened to me when I was a kid. And people would look at me like, oh my God, that's horrible. That's awful. And you're like, and I could see the concern on their faces. And I think it was through those experiences and then another psychedelic journey where I kind of identified that time in my life and those experiences of being held down as sort of the root of my issues, my people pleasing. I am not worthy. I am here for other people's pleasure. I am here for other people's amusement. I don't have a voice of my own that means anything. I tried to complain to my mother about what happened, and she's just like, why? Why are you telling me this? Why would you tell anybody about this? They were just having fun. You know what? Those are the people who love you, which I have subsequently put into the lyrics of some of the songs on my new album. And so that's kind of to answer the CPTSD question. That's kind of when I realized, and it's similar to what you've talked about. I never thought I had it that bad as a kid. I thought my childhood was kind of normal and my parents were super loving. But in fact, it was like kind of the repeated neglectful behaviors, the repeated kind of lack of feeling any like feedback on my worth as a person from my caretakers, the grind of growing up in that versus having any one or two big, powerful incidents. Like that's kind of when I recognize that what I have gone through or what I'm experiencing now is CPTSD.
Have you experienced emotional flashbacks? I'm sure you have, but like when has that, what has triggered that?
Yeah, in fact, that's kind of what led to the current family estrangement. It was during the pandemic, late 2020, early 2021. I was communicating with my sister about something.
How many siblings do you have?
Oh, yeah. I have three older brothers and an older sister. My oldest brother, John, was like 19 years older than me, kind of like an uncle. He passed away back in 2010. And he was the one I related to the most, absolutely.
Like, from like addiction or?
Just kind of like from being a quirky weirdo, an undiagnosed neurodivergent type of person who doesn't quite fit in. Okay. Yeah, he passed away. I have two additional older brothers who are neurotypical and love their mom and have a relationship with our mom that I don't have. And then my sister, who is 8 years older than me and who is the golden child, basically. I know people are familiar with those terms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the sibling. And what was the...
You're talking about the incident that led to your estrangement. So you were talking, it was over the pandemic, right? And you were talking to your sister.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah. I was talking with my sister, I think texting with her.
Are they all back in Wisconsin still?
My two remaining brothers are. My sister lives in Omaha, Nebraska, which is, you know, not too far, still upper Midwest and still kind of that same sort of culture. Yeah. And so I was communicating with my sister and she brought up some things that I couldn't figure it out, but it was like making me feel really angry and making me feel like I was a little kid who wasn't being heard. And it like really brought back those feelings of being held down. And in this case, not literally, but I started recognizing how like there's no difference. There's like such a strong relationship between the times I was literally held down and the times I was like figuratively held down by my parents and the family system. Mm-hmm. And this was what was seemed to be playing out in these communications with my sister. And I got angry and heated and had an argument. And I mentioned what happened when I was a kid with the being held down, tickled till I peed my pants. And it's like, you knew this happened. You were present for this. You didn't, like, maybe you didn't feel like you could have stopped it, but man, you could have said something about this. And I got lots of, like, kind of denial and, oh, that never happened. I don't remember it that way sort of stuff from her. Mm-hmm. Then what really, like, I was just feeling so, so angry, so upset, and so, like, I need to express this. So I wrote a blog post about it, just about the stuff that happened as a kid and also what I've done to kind of heal from that now that I've recognized that. And it was like, it's my, like, the most popular thing on my website by far. It's like, it's resonated with so many people and it's connected with so many people.
I'll put it in the show notes too.
Oh, cool. And it's called Dear Little Matt. It's a letter to my young self, and which is like a pretty common, like technique for healing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, we've all, anybody who's been through this stuff has done something similar. I just happened to do it publicly, but in a way, like, I didn't name any names. I just said, this stuff happened to me when I was a kid. It's affected me. Maybe it's stuff like this has affected you. Here as I well. Am yeah. working through it. And that was too much for my mom. The fact that I posted something publicly.
How'd she find it?
She,
were you like publicly promoting it, or she just stumbled upon it?
Yeah, I think I was like promoting it on social media. I don't think I sent it to my family necessarily. I think maybe a couple days later, I sent a text asking if anybody had had a chance to read it. My thinking honestly was, though, like, yeah, this might cause some turbulence, but really what this is going
to, yeah, come to terms exactly, with some things. Yeah.
Exactly. This is what's going to get us all to heal. This is what's going to, like, get us stronger as a family unit, because, like, I'm not the only one who suffered any abuses. Mm-hmm. Like, my older brothers went to Catholic school where they were literally beaten by the nuns. And that's a story they tell and they laugh about, and everybody's looks at them with deep concern. So I wrote this blog post. My mom caught wind of it, and she didn't contact me. She texted my partner, Annie, and was like, hey, do you have your eye on Matt? Are you taking care of Matt? Is he okay? What's going on? Like, totally flipping out. And then we scheduled a phone call, my mom and I, to talk about this stuff, in which she completely denied any of this happened. She denied that I ever came to her as a boy. Mm-hmm. She denied, like, any of her responsibility. She really pissed me off, and she got me to the point where I started yelling at her while she was still sitting there. Well, that never happened. Your father and I were preparing you for the real world, you know, all the tough love bullshit. And so it was just doubling down, defending herself. I ended up yelling at her to fuck off, and I hung up the phone. She texted me back a few minutes later saying, have fun with your new family. And that's the last I ever heard from my mom or any member of the family. Well, I take that back. I received a typewritten letter from one of my brothers about a week later admonishing me for swearing at our mother and that I've gone crazy. I should probably get help. In the meantime, we need to distance ourselves from you. And it was almost as if they were like setting it up or
mm-hmm. yeah,
as if they need to protect themselves from me. I was like, wait a second. And so, yeah, lots and lots of therapy after that. And I was in a real bad place after that happened, because, like I said, I really did think, and maybe I should have known better, but I really did think that this could lead to healing. This could lead to a discussion that cracked some of this open, that where we could be authentic with one another and help each other and cry with one another.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like so normal. I think we're always going to have that to like a certain extent. It's like, even once we internalize it and like know that to really be true, I think it's unrealistic to think that hope won't pop up from time to time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And even to this day, like I've grieved the loss of my family as if, and that's part of the album I've created, which is called Family Plot, which is like there are multiple meanings there, but I've buried them in the family plot because I've grieved their loss, because I don't see a way back into the family fold. I don't see them coming to apologize to me. I don't see us ever having those discussions. They've doubled down. They've schemed their ways of getting their stories straight about me. So when people ask about me in the extended family or the community, it's just not happening. And so I've had to grieve them. I've had to like grieve their loss as if it is the final loss, as if it is their death. And that's where we're at with that. And there is no hope for healing at this point in the way that I imagined when I kind of came out with this stuff. Yeah.
What, do you have any contact with anybody from your past?
A little bit. The immediate family, no. I do have my brother, who is now my oldest brother mm-hmm. passed away, but Mark, who is 17 years older than me, he and his wife is on social media, Tracy, and she'll check my stuff. She'll like my posts, but we've never like talked about any of this mm-hmm. stuff. And I know, I feel reasonably certain this brother, Mark, has kind of filled my previous role of the family scapegoat now. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who's the problem. He's the one who can't get his shit together, et cetera, et cetera. And I was actually, his son, my nephew, I was communicating with him recently, and he kind of spilled the beans on a lot of the internal mm-hmm. family stuff about me. And he's a lot like me. I can see him having a very similar early adulthood into later adulthood experiences as I had, dealing with this stuff, dealing with the type of upbringing he had. And yeah, he reached out on social media and mentioned some things and illuminated some things and kind of reinforced how I know, and God bless this young man, who is like 20 years old, but he recognized that I know something isn't right about this, and I hate that you're not around in the family anymore. And I think it's really shitty for them to have cut you out completely like that and to have gotten their story straight and done the scheming they've done to basically make me seem in the community like I've just completely gone off the rails and they are in fact protecting themselves from the craziness that is Matt.
Well, if he can see it, I'm sure other people can too.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have much of a relationship with him prior to ending the relationship with your brother?
A little bit, just kind of, you know, seeing it at family functions and stuff. He's up in Wisconsin, of course, and I'm out here in New Mexico, so not really seeing, but there's definitely like a connection there where it's like we kind of see each other in a way. It's like, oh, you're like me, I'm like you. Like we've got a thing, even though it was never kind of acknowledged or said out loud. There was a recognition there, and we would always kind of gravitate towards each other at family functions. And he and I were the ones who would always, like, if we'd play Trivial Pursuit or something like that, we would always clean up and win. And like, that's where we shined in the family roles. So yeah.
What do you know about your parents' upbringings?
It was rough. It was rough, especially my mom. And there's so much generational stuff that comes through her line, like kind of harsh Scandinavian heritage, where her mother, my grandmother, was raised by a very stern, unforgiving, and brutal matriarch. And it was believed that this is the way families survive. This is the way people survive in the world. The world is harsh. My mother was raised during World War II. She was born during the Great Depression. And
were they living in Wisconsin at that point?
Yes, yeah. My whole family sprung up from rural Wisconsin, basically. And on my mom's side, yeah, there's a lot of, like, her father passed away at a very young age. She didn't know her father, and she was raised by an emotionally immature person who only knew stern, tough, rigid, we don't say I love you, we aren't soft, we're tough upbringing. That's what my mom knew, and that's how she had to survive, and that's what she brought to her own motherhood. And she was 17 when she got pregnant with my oldest brother. And so, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of life experience. There wasn't a whole lot of education. God. And there were no models for, you know, how to be a mature, emotionally responsible and emotionally mature adult in the world raising kids. You know, kids raising kids. My dad was a couple years older, but still a kid himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, culturally, central Wisconsin, rural Midwestern, very quiet, keep to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about ourselves. We don't put ourselves out there. What we do is we chop wood and we prepare for the long, hard winter. And yeah, it's there's no room for self-expression. There's no room for lovey-dovey softness. There's no room for talking about people's feelings. And that's just kind of the culture I was steeped in and the culture they certainly were steeped in, especially my mom.
And like, so then what was the relationship like between your parents?
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
Do you shit shows ever feel like you're just too damn busy to eat healthy? So I used to feel this way. Every day I would wake up with the intention of eating clean, and before you know it, it's 10:30 p.m., I'm in my bed, and I'm eating smart food popcorn. That is, until I found the perfect solution. Meal kits from Sunbasket. No matter what your lifestyle is, Sunbasket caters to your kind of healthy. Every single recipe is shit show proof, so pre-measured, pre-proportioned, easy to prepare. I most recently made the seared Alaskan halibut with mashed potatoes and herb brown butter parmesan sauce, and it was damn good. And for you shit shows out there who only know how to work a microwave, Sunbasket also has pre-made meals that are ready to eat in less than 5 minutes. No prep, no mess. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 off your first four deliveries. That is sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your very first order.
Now I know that it's pretty codependent. It was a pretty codependent, really, my mom being the narcissist, my dad kind of being the, how do I keep everything, like keep all the plates spinning and nothing is falling and crashing. I got to keep Carol, my mom, happy. Oh no, the kids, I got to running around.
That's my grandma's name.
Oh, yeah. My mom, Carol Ann. So yeah, my dad is kind of the enabler, kind of the gentle soul, kind of the easygoing, which is kind of how I learned how to be, like not really getting too upset about things. Like I get so sensitive though, but never allowing himself to cry or express an emotion. Yeah, I loved my dad so much, but now it's been difficult actually kind of recognizing the enabling that, like, you know, he's not as responsible maybe as my mom, but he is responsible for maintaining the structure of the family and the narcissistic structure.
I think that's really common to when you read, like when the anger starts to come up to the parent who allowed it to happen, you know?
Yeah, totally. And so, and it's, there's another layer to that, the fact that he passed away before like this stuff really came up. So And it wouldn't have come up if he were still around. The fact that he is no longer here is what kind of led to the opening where my mom can kind of like be an asshole to me, that my dad isn't being like, hey, Carol, come on, he's really trying here, or, you know, whatever the thing may have been. So yeah, the estrangement, the rift never would have happened if my dad wouldn't have passed away. But like, I, now that he's gone, now is when I know like his role in it. And now I understand his role in it. And I can't talk to anybody about that who was there. I certainly can't talk to him about it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is a lot of anger there. There is so much deep love. And I'm so happy I had him in my life to give me the encouragement that I had. Like, he bought me my guitar. He paid for my music lessons. And he showed up to gigs when I was in bands and starting out and stuff like that. And that meant so much, so much. And so there is still that, but now there is just that other layer of it's not 100% that. It's also like he did a lot of work enabling the abuse and the neglect that was happening at home as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then talk about your relationship with music. Like, when did you start to play?
It was from a very early age. I remember bringing pots and pans and household items onto the school bus on the way to kindergarten and trying to loop my friends into like starting a band. Here, you take the wooden spoon and hit this pot. I have like this little slide whistle. I'll play that. Here, you sing this part. Johnny, you hit the back of the school bus seat and we'll play a song. And like, nobody else was into it. I was like, come on, guys, let's do it. Let's make some music. Let's be in a band. So very early on, like I was so drawn to music and musicianship and sort of like the aesthetics of music. And like the times when I got to, we didn't have cable in my house growing up, but when I went to the like an aunt's or uncle's house in the city and I got to see early MTV in 82, 83, it was like, oh my God, that's what I want. This is me. This is my life. Then fast forward, when I was around 12 or 13, I found an old acoustic guitar in the basement of our house. And I started plucking around on it. It had like four strings, not the typical six strings you need. My older brother had played some guitar and he taught me how to tune it and got it restrung. And I just kind of took off and it came very easily, very naturally to me. And my dad recognized that. And that's when he bought me a proper guitar, a proper instrument, and started taking me to lessons. And then it's just never, I can't say that. It has let up quite a bit because I didn't think I was worthy of pursuing an artistic career or pursuing any kind of artistry in my life. So it, and yet it's been there the whole time. And part of my spiritual awakening was kind of recognizing that, no, fuck it. The best I'm going to do at anything is through music, is through artistry. It's like, that's what connects me with people. That's where I have the biggest upside, the highest ceiling versus whatever bullshit I'm trying to do to please my mom and work in an office or whatever else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What were the messages that you received as a kid related to, like, I don't know, like career or art or music? Like, what did your dad do for a living?
Yeah, my dad was a farmer, vegetables, crops, but primarily potatoes.
Did you guys grow up on a farm?
Yeah, exactly. No animals. Like, we had a dog and a cat, but it wasn't like a dairy farm, or we didn't have pigs or anything like that. Purely just vegetables, cash crops. So, and his father before him was a farmer. Like, I come from farmers, agriculture type people. Is that right?
Yeah, I will inherit a farm one day if my dad doesn't sell it.
Wow.
In central Illinois.
No shit.
220 acres. Wow. Corn and soybeans.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my world that I grew up in. Yeah, yeah. How does that make you feel, the prospect of potentially
I don't know what the fuck to do with it. Yeah, my dad's parents, yeah, they're both from central Illinois, and my grandfather, he became a pilot. So he was kind of like the only one that got out of there, but he had two farms that he kept and farmed. Like, he had other people do it for him. But yeah, so then my uncle got one and my dad got the other. My uncle sold his, but my dad still has it. And he probably goes and visits it once a year. And so it's like haunted, supposedly. I mean, I used to go a little bit when I was younger, a few times, but same thing, no livestock, no animals. So it was not cool. It would have been like, I would have loved to have gone if there was like fucking animals, you know, there's fucking corn stalks.
Yeah. I remember like a lot of like pulling weeds. There was like picking rocks was one of the chores, like going up and down the rows of the field and picking rocks out of the ground so they wouldn't hurt the plow. Yeah. Just lots of stuff.
So were you like, did any of your brothers continue the farming?
Yes, I have the brother who eventually wrote me the letter disowning me was kind of the next in line of the family farm. And he was sort of my dad's right hand person in the operations up to the point where my dad retired. And then at that point, it just didn't make sense for my brother to take over, because being a small independent farmer is just not it doesn't work anymore because the corporate farms have taken over. So ended up selling it all off, and my brother got a job in the city and stuff like that. But you know, had it gone that way, had it stayed in the family, that brother would have taken it over.
So what were the messages that you received related to like how you were supposed to pursue like a career?
Very Midwestern hard work ethic. And anything that isn't like hard work, earning a living stuff is relegated to, that's a hobby. That's something you can do once all the chores are done. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The chores are never done. And so, it's certainly not a pursuit worthy of like devoting one's life to as a career. It's something like, once all the other stuff is done, once you've earned your money, once you've earned your living and you've got your insurance taken care of, all of those things, then you can pursue music. Yeah. And then it's as a hobby, you know, get some guys together in the garage and, you know, don't take it. We only want to protect you because we know how much it hurts to be rejected. Rejected and criticized by society. And so that was totally the vibe. Yeah. Yeah.
And so then when you graduated high school, what did you end up doing?
The plan was to go to Berklee College of Music in Boston.
Uh-huh.
But then that was like, it it just couldn't happen financially. My dad had a really bad year on the farm with potato blight. It was kind of devastating, actually.
A girl in the community, she went to school there. And she's from North Dakota.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
She's cattle cattle farmers.
Oh shit.
Scandinavian.
Wow.
Norwegian. Wow. Norwegian.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's me. Wow. That's that's pretty wild. Yeah. And so like I was meeting with Berkeley people and stuff like that, but then like kind of not the 11th hour, but it just became like, oh, we can't afford this. And I wasn't like I wasn't getting scholarships and I wasn't like making any money significantly anyway with any like working on the farm or whatever job I had. So that wasn't going to go. So I ended up going to the state school just down the road from where I grew up. Didn't live in the dorms, lived in my old bedroom at home, not really setting myself up for success or like breaking away from the family bonds and the whatever else was going on there. And so naturally, I dropped out in the middle of my first semester there. There were a couple other attempts at like doing college stuff, but never in any field I had any
passion towards.
Aptitude or interest in, like computer programming. And so I dropped out again and again. Meanwhile, I got a job working at a sort of farm / retail sporting goods store called Fleet Farm, which is people in the Midwest will know the name Fleet Farm. It's sort of like a Lowe's combined with a Cabela's or something like that. And like I was selling like lawnmowers there. That was my job for 6.5 years. And I would see people come in who I went to school with who were like starting families and living their dreams. And
getting
I'm
the first lawnmower.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I was just kind of stuck there. And eventually, like, I found myself in my mid-20s, not really pursuing music. I was in like a cover band. But I had a bold idea. I was going to move 100 miles south to Madison, Wisconsin, the sophisticated college town with culture and everything. And I ended up going to school for audio engineering and production, which was like more in my wheelhouse. And I learned a lot there. Still dropped out, but still like hit bottom again. And that's when, you know, I got my car repossessed and evicted from my apartment. But I learned some valuable skills there. And I got connected with actual people like me in the world. Like I figured out that we exist out there. And so that was like really important to kind of move farther away from home, kind of start to find my people. Even though I like continued the pattern of dropping out and being a failure or whatever, I was getting closer to pursuing the thing that I should have been pursuing all along.
What kind of cover band were you in?
It was actually like a blues band. And we did play like a lot of originals, but like we played like B.B. King songs, Freddie King songs, like Muddy Waters, stuff like that. And where I come from, it's such close proximity to the Chicago blues scene that stuff is very popular. And I took a liking to it as a very young guitar player as well. And so, yeah, kind of like blues-based rock kind of stuff, like for the guys with ponytails, you know.
Did you know that I'm a yacht rock whore? I love
yacht
rock.
I didn't know that. You mentioned Billy Joel, who is, I guess, yacht rock adjacent.
Yeah, adjacent. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me more about your yacht rock.
I just really love it. There was this band and there was a cover band in San Francisco, Mustache Harbor. And God, they're just so fucking good. I mean, it's so good. It's like, you know, like Hole & Oates, The Eagle, Boss Skaggs, you know, Petty.
Yeah, yeah.
Lionel Richie. Fuck, yeah. I'll take it. It's like the best music to dance to. I have to show you this. So one time I was there and they were playing Man Eater by Hall & Oates. And there was this, like old guy and he was doing this dance move and he was going like this. Like a Pac-Man, and he was like going there. I was like, dude, that's the best fucking move ever. So now that's my signature move.
Yeah, I love
good?
That.
That's a
good
move.
That's one of the better moves I've seen. I have to say,
yes.
Top five move.
Yes. Oh, totally. Yeah. So, like, yeah. But you know what? It was actually part of my origin story of starting the podcast was like, I was on this journey to like figure out like what makes me special. And they would come every couple months to San Francisco. Have you been to San Francisco before?
Yeah, many times.
There's a theater, it's called Bimbo's. Okay. And it's been there since like the 20s. And it's very like Red Booth, Sinatra-ish. And so I'd always go. And so I went on a Friday night. But I went with one of my friends and he wasn't like as into it as me. So I wasn't able to fully enjoy myself, you know, because I'm like the type of person, like, don't go to a show with me if like you can't hold your own, because I'm just going to like bop around and just talk to everybody, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the next night. I'm going to buy 2 tickets. I'll either go alone or if I find somebody that'll be as into it as me, then I'll take them. And so I was going by myself, and it was like this whole series of events occurred to like get me into this one like Lyft, like a Lyft driver. And then Hall & Oates came on the radio, and I could tell that the driver was kind of like bopping a little bit. And I was like, oh, do you like Hall & Oates? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, well, you're actually taking me to a show right now where this is the music that they play. And he was like, oh, I love this kind of music. And I was like, I have an extra ticket. Like, do you want to come with me? And so then he went. And then it was at the very end, and they were playing, it was a Paul McCartney song. But I just remember, like, I just had this like rush come over me. And I was like, Andrea, you're so cool. I was like, who does this?
Yeah.
I was like, what sober chick just like fucking goes to the concert by invites the fucking Lyft driver? And I was like, there's something really special about you.
Yeah.
And I was at a Mustache Harbor thing. And then this was the craziest. So then I was moving away, and it was my last time there. I went to a show. And so I always, you know, I always typically find like, I like to find like a guy, like, I don't know, like maybe early 60s. I kind of bring like dude energy just so they know, like, you know, I'm not interested. And what I do is I come up to them and I'm like, you want to play like a Name That Tune? Like, so when they start playing the song, and then they're like blown away because I like kick their like two. That's actually one of my hidden talents is that I can hear music in a really loud restaurant that nobody else can hear, and I can name it. And so then I start talking to this guy and I'm playing that game. And then at a certain point, I'm like, guess what? I was like, I'm completely sober, because I'm like assuming that he probably thinks that I'm like super fucking drunk.
Right. Naturally.
I've been sober for 6 months. And then I said, what's your name? And he said, Brian.
Oh my goodness.
I went to my very first Mustache Harbor concert with Brian Number Two. He was the one that like his neighbors were going to it. And it was such a full circle moment, because it was like, I moved to San Francisco to meet the Bryans and like to meet my therapist. And then for it to be like the closing chapter. And I was there with my friend who I'd met through my podcast community, you know? And so it was just such a full, like, I never went to one of their shows where there wasn't some like weird spiritual experience of like interacting with somebody. So.
Yeah. Those moments, it makes me think of like, I think of a hole punch, and it's like, we've got all these pieces of paper that are stacked together, and we bring them together with the hole punch. We can see through every sheet of paper. It's the sheet of paper with the Hall & Oates. It's the sheet of paper with being in San Francisco. It's like all of it combined together, and it has Pac-Man on it. And it's
Man-Eater. Exactly.
Yeah. How often do you hear from people like either way? Like, oh my God, I'm so glad I found you. You're so great. Finally, somebody who speaks like this, or the other way, like, you're not for me.
I hear from people a lot. I mean, I'll get like stuff like, I wish that you didn't curse so much so I could listen to this. There's not that many adult child podcasts out there. So I really wish you could appeal to everyone. And that goes totally against like what I represent.
Yeah. That's like,
well, that actually goes totally goes against adult child recovery, actually. Right. And then I had somebody get pissed off because I said this guy I wanted a date with in San Francisco was a pussy because he wouldn't eat pizza.
Hilarious. Yeah. And sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, right. Yeah. If you're trying to please everyone, then you're just a people pleaser.
Exactly.
And we're trying to get away from that.
I said, I don't want to date somebody who doesn't want to fuck up a pizza with me. And she said that I was contributing to toxic masculinity. Fuck you. The only time I've really gotten bothered is like when people have made comments that like they think I'm being, and I don't know why it bothers me, because it's not true, but people will think I'm being disrespectful to guests, like when I'm making jokes and stuff like that. And like, that's never the case. Like, they know what they're getting into.
Yeah, they must know what they're getting into. Yes. Like, they wouldn't come on your show if it was just a complete cold experience where, like, oh my, clutching their pearls at you. Like, yeah. And I can see that, because I don't know, just being such a, and they're, I don't know if you identify as a highly sensitive person, but just being a sensitive person, like, yeah, that stuff kind of, it causes a little ripple in me. But then it's like, I listen, it's like, no, these people wouldn't be on the show. They wouldn't be having this conversation. And it's almost like, no, this is more home than home, because like, these people are getting along. Like, that person is cool with this vibe. Otherwise they wouldn't be there. I definitely
occasionally do, but I think I have to be like a little bit less sensitive than the average adult child to be able to do this, probably. Right. Cause I don't think most people could.
Oh yeah. You've got to have like a little more armor, and that's That's what I'm finding too. It's really easy to like just kind of sit back and me and my partner and my cat, and like occasionally we go out in the world, but just really putting oneself out there is like, yeah, you have to have such a leathery, tough, thick skin about stuff, which is not easy.
And I hadn't really thought about this before, but in my interview yesterday, when I was telling Susan about my experience of being ostracized, like in middle school, and how my approach to it was, kind of just like to lean into it and be like, fuck you. And she goes, I think that like there was probably some like post-traumatic growth from that experience in the sense of like, you being able to really individuate and like kind of. And so I think that that probably does, like, I mean, that experience was so devastating in so many ways, but I think that it did must have helped me like kind of be comfortable with like, this is who I am and take it or leave it.
I guess you don't know until you know, unless until you like try it. And yeah, now you've been like reinforcing that. Like when you started like putting yourself out there and going public with this stuff, starting the podcast, was there any consideration for like the persona you were going to embody, or was it always just, no, I'm just going
No,
to
this
be
is me.
myself? Yeah, that's great.
I don't know how to be any other way. It's not like an option.
That's
There
amazing.
was thoughts around how much do I want to share about my parents? And they asked me, when my mom, initially my mom was like, please just keep me and your dad out of it. And I said, you know, this is something that I've thought a lot about, and I've talked with a bit my therapist, and I said, it's important that I talk about what my experience was, but I said, I'll make sure that I do it in a way that like emphasizes that a loving family and a dysfunctional family aren't mutually exclusive. And, you know, they're just a product of their upbringings as well, you know? And I said, but I won't really share about what's like currently been going on. 'Cause honestly, like the years leading up to the podcast, like things were even worse and continue to get worse. And so then as the podcast has gone on and they've kind of deteriorated more and more, I've been more open about like what like it's like now.
Are you familiar with that? It makes me think of, there's an Anne Lamott quote. She's a writer who writes about writing, and she says, I'm paraphrasing, your story, you own your story. It's yours to tell. If the people you're writing about didn't want to be written about a certain way, they should have treated you more warmly. And
Love
so
that.
that's kind of the approach I take. I can just tell my story. If they're welcome to tell their stories. My mom is welcome to record her own album or write her book or start her podcast or blog. Like there's nobody stopping anybody in my family from doing that. And so, you know, this is my story to tell. And yeah, there is sort of a, I want to be respectful to a point and not fuck with people's privacy or stuff like that. But, you know, stuff happened to me, and it was like stuff happened by people, was done by people. And like, so I'm going to talk about those people and what they did and how they impacted me. So,
I
yeah.
think it's like if somebody is like taking responsibility like for their own healing, I think it's one thing if somebody's just out there like, you know, just poor me, like all this that I went through and they're not doing anything about it. I think that that's one thing, but like I don't know. Like, if you're taking responsibility for your own healing, like you're entitled to your story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's like the primary difference between me and the rest of my family. It's like I'm, and that's why we're estranged, is because I started bringing this stuff up, which is like, you know what I've noticed, like putting stuff out there, and I'm sure this is true for you to me, and maybe you can speak on this, is just how fucking common this is. Like it's almost more common than it is not for people to come
Absolutely.
from this sort of upbringing.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So tell me
Yeah.
about your album that's coming out.
Yes, the album is called Family Plot, and so multiple meanings there, like a family plot. We bury them in. There's also like the family plot to have their way to talk about what happened in the family, their scheming to discuss how I ended up becoming estranged. And then just another layer on top of that is the year I was born, 1976, Alfred Hitchcock released his final film entitled Family Plot. So there's just a few layers of meaning there. It's got 20 tracks. It's sort of alternative hardcore punk rock music, but it was also heavily influenced by music I liked when I was a mullet-headed little kid, like Motley Crue and Poison and Rat and Judas Priest and stuff like that. It's highly irreverent. I think adult children and fans of you, Andrea, will if they're fans
Enjoy the
of
F
you,
words.
there, yes, there's a like upwards of 140 F words on the album. And the average song length is 2 minutes. It's just like fast and intense. Mm-hmm. And it gets in and it gets out. The first side one of the album is all about kind of the childhood trauma, the estrangement, the stuff that happened when I was a kid. Side two is about the healing. It's about finding the others. It's about pursuing the music. It's about coming to a place of healing in spite of everything that happened. Also a little bit because of everything that happened. The album comes out June 21st. The first single is called The Shame Shovel.
Yeah, I listened to it.
You shoveled shame on me. Mm-hmm. That song is available everywhere music streams. Yeah, a new single will be coming out next week. Next week, the single is called Celebrate the Sensitive. And it's all for all of us very sensitive people. And yeah, the album will come out in just over a month on June 21st, everywhere music streams.
So I hope that you're going to be doing some tours at all the local bars in your hometown.
I'd like to. That's kind
so
of
phase, good. It was so
phase
good.
Two of this. Yeah, totally.
I would come.
Yeah. Like phase two is putting the band together, getting the merch ready, plotting the tour, and getting out there and playing the music for
and
the people.
And then somehow trick your parents and your mom into coming and have her not know.
No, right, right.
And then have somebody hold her down. And tickle her until she pisses her pants while you're
right.
Fucking up on stage playing.
There you go. How did you read my mind? This is
I went there, folks.
Yeah, yeah. Like that is my vision of success, actually, for this album.
Oh,
it won't
that's
be successful
a dream.
Until that scenario unfolds. But yeah, the album is coming out in June, and that's what I'm promoting these days. And I want to connect with people who are into like rock music, who are into alternative rock and that vibe and those bands I mentioned, but also I want to connect and build community with people like who are members of your audience as well, because so many people have been through this stuff. And in particular, creative people I want to speak to and male identifying people, men like me, because it's forever, like every 8 women I see in these communities, maybe there's one man. So like, I really want to connect and get the dialogue going more among people like me, our male identifying friends.
Male identifying friends. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome. I really appreciate your time. All right, Chit Shows, if you were someone who constantly finds yourself giving, and then giving more to the point where you are completely burnt out, listen up. I am teaming up with the Boundaries Queen herself, Barb Nangle, to host a transformative workshop called Stop Overgiving, Repair Your Life from the Inside Out. It's happening on Wednesday, November 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and this workshop is for anyone who is trapped in people-pleasing patterns, exhausted from sacrificing your needs on behalf of others, for anyone whose inability to set boundaries is causing you to neglect yourself, saying yes when you really want to say no because you think saying no makes you a bad person. In this workshop, Barb is going to teach you how to set clear, authentic boundaries, giving you real tools you can start using immediately. She will provide you with tips and scripts on what to say and how to say it, as well as what to do when people push back against your boundaries. Plus, there will be plenty of time for you to get answers on your personal questions directly from a boundaries expert. So if you are ready to break out of this people-pleasing prison you're trapped in, start living for yourself, well, how about you head to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops to get your damn spot. I'm also running a special right now. If you join the Shit Show community between now and November 1st, you will get access to this workshop for free. So with limited capacity, make sure you get your ticket now before it's gone. So either go to adultchildpodcast.com/workshops or go to the show notes and damn the Join Shit Show. Trust me, this is a workshop you don't want to miss.